Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, thanks for joining us again. I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and that long-winded title just means that I'm your garden science translator. I take information that I find in articles written by other university professors, or sometimes articles written by me, and I translate it so you can use it in your own garden. It'll help you save time, money, and natural resources. Sometimes I'll take you out of your comfort zone a little bit, but that's all good. That's how we learn new things. And each week, I'll try to follow some kind of theme. And today's theme is garden hocus pocus. We'll also head outside to chat with Seattle plantsman Riz Reyes to find out just what caused him to devote his life to growing tropical plants outside in our most definitely non-tropical Pacific Northwest climate. But first, let's look at garden hocus pocus in the news. Well, my first news tidbit is actually old news, or really ancient news. It's about a Greek philosophy called the Doctrine of Signatures. Early doctors believed that plants that looked like human body parts could actually be used to treat illnesses of those very same body parts. For instance, there's lung warts and liver warts and spleen warts. If you look at them, they kind of look like lungs or livers or spleens, and they were thought to have medicinal value in treating diseases of those very same organs. Knobby ginger root was thought to cure arthritis, because you think about arthritis, you have, you know, knobby knuckles, and so you use a knobby-looking plant part. And then heart-shaped leaves of different plants were thought to be used to cure heart ailments. Walnuts, if you look at one, next time you crack one open, they look like miniature brains. And if you hold up a St. John's wort leaf to the sun, you'll see it has tiny pinpricks in the leaves. And that reminded people of the pores of the skin. So with all these similarities that people could find, we thought it was kind of a magical way that nature was communicating with mankind, telling us what plants could be used to help us. Well, unfortunately, reality and this doctrine of signatures don't really match up very well. We're going to take carrots as an example. So one branch of the signatures philosophy believes that roots have an effect on the lower part of the body. Well, okay, a carrot is kind of phallic-shaped, and so you might think that it would have aphrodisiac properties. Well, there's no such luck, which probably relieved our mothers, who always encouraged us to eat our carrots. But you remember, we were supposed to eat carrots because they could help us see better. And guess what? If you take a slice of carrot and look at it, it kind of looks like an eye. And so believers claim that this predicts the effect of eating carrots on improving your eyesight. So this belief persisted well into the 17th century and is actually even still popular today among some alternative medicine groups. So I went Googling, and anytime you go Googling with things like magical plants, you can imagine what kinds of things you get. But I finally stumbled across the Flower Essence Society. Now, I've never heard of this group before, and I did not know that you could actually become a certified flower essence practitioner. So in addition to this classic doctrine of signatures, a certified flower essence practitioner also relies on what plant family characteristics are. And so an example of this was actually on their website, and I'm going to read it to you verbatim. Dill and Queen Anne's lace are among the members of the family of plants known as umbellifera, meaning that they are all umbrella-shaped. On the essence level, this family of plants shields us from bombardment by our psychic and social environment in the same ways that umbrellas shield us from our physical environment. So that's what it takes to be a certified flower essence practitioner. And you know, I'm not really trying to make fun of all this, because it's only human to look for patterns in nature. It's just what we do. It helps us understand and explain our world. But from a scientific perspective, there's no evidence at all that the way a plant looks has anything to do with medicinal properties. What it's really useful for, though, is a memory device so that we can learn what plant names are based on the way that they look. So our next item, keeping the theme of garden hocus pocus, has to do with plant biochemistry. Don't worry, I'm not going to be boring, it's not going to be painful, and this is actually going to be really fun. We're going to look at magical plants. There's a great website I found called Wayne's Word. And so it's Wayne's Word, not Wayne's World. And it's maintained by a Palomar faculty member named Wayne Armstrong. Among the nifty items you can find on waynesword.palomar.edu is an essay on plant alkaloids. Now, what alkaloids are is a group of chemicals that plants make, and it's only one of a wide variety of plant-made chemicals. And what's special about them is their historical role in medicine and magic. So if you're wondering what an alkaloid is, it includes things like stimulants. This would be things like our morning stimulants of caffeine, also includes nicotine and cocaine. Then there's some alkaloids that have narcotic properties. things like codeine and morphine. And then there's another group that are the psychoactive hallucinogens, and those are the ones that are derived from peyote cactus, and Jimson weed, and a lot of other interesting plants. And these are the types of compounds that were really important in love potions and witches' brews and shamanism and all of the mystical magic that you can see through the centuries with a lot of different cultures. Well, the alkaloids have one thing in common. They all contain nitrogen. Now, when plant scientists first started looking at plant biochemistry, they found these odd chemicals that had all this nitrogen. They first of all thought they were waste compounds. Kind of like we produce urine, which is very high in nitrogen. Other animals produce urea. And so they just thought, okay, well, this is the waste product that plants make. But since then, we've learned that nitrogen is really a very precious resource for plants, and it's unlikely they're going to be discarding it because it's very hard to get sometimes, depending on where they're growing. It's really a lot more likely these plants play a role in chemical warfare. And what I mean by that is they're defensive compounds against herbivores, or things that eat plants. So let's consider a typical plant feeding insect, you know, an aphid or some kind of leaf beetle that happens to nibble on a leaf containing a stimulant such as nicotine. Well, nicotine is a really powerful insecticide, so if the insect isn't killed outright by eating this compound, it might be stimulated to a point that it can't feed anymore and actually could fall right off the leaf. Narcotics might slow the feeding response down, and hallucinogens might make them think they were at a Woodstock revival. In any case, the function of these chemicals is to disrupt insect feeding. If the feeding's disrupted, it means the insect is getting less food, it means they're less likely to survive and or reproduce, meaning next time around there's fewer of those nibblers to be bothering the plant. So that's where the plants win, in the chemical warfare. But, evolution being what it is, some insects actually will develop resistance to alkaloids and other types of plant compounds. Some of them can even store the poisons in their tissues and use them to resist their own predators. The classic example is the monarch butterfly, and the larva of the monarchs eats milkweed. Milkweed contains a poisonous sap, but rather than killing the larvae, it actually helps them because they're not eaten by other predators like birds, either as juveniles or as adults. So now they've used the plant defenses for their own purposes, and they're still eating the plant. So that time, the insects win. And then down the line, the plants are going to make new chemicals that nothing is resistant to, and so on and so forth. This is kind of the constant one-upmanship we see in plant defenses, and insect resistance is a really fascinating study of evolution in action. A tropical garden paradise in Seattle? Really? Well, leave it to Plants on Riz Reyes to discover which tropical plants also do well in our not-so-tropical climate. Riz says that gardeners in our region can push the envelope a little bit with their plant selections.
A lot of gardeners here in the Northwest can definitely take pride in that. Being able to grow, you know, palms and, you know, and that sort of thing. And there was this whole tropicalismo, you know, period where everyone wanted, you know, big, bold foliage and, you know, gunnera and that sort of thing. And it's been interesting to see the trends kind of, you know, ebb and flow. And it's kind of different now because a lot of people are trying to, you know, they're aiming for low maintenance and that sort of thing, which is great. I think people are beginning to realize their lifestyle and what they can take on, and they can appreciate, you know, lush and extravagant gardens such as this. And at the same time, it's when people think of gardens, that's what, you know, they want to see. They like the perennial borders, they like the vegetable gardens, and they think that, you know, that's what a garden should be. And they think, oh my gosh, how could I possibly have the time to do all of that? So they resort to just, you know, simple kind of quick fixes and that sort of thing, and you know, with very mixed results. I think you got to go all out, I think, you know, and learn as you go, and you make mistakes along the way, and we always have to tell people that, you know, it's how you learn. I can't tell you how many thousands of plants I've killed, you know, just trying to get it to grow, and you know, and so you learn each time, and you learn what works for you. And I think that's one thing too that as gardeners we have to keep in mind is, you know, you kind of develop your own style. You know, it's nurturing that art of horticulture, because it's both art and the science, and that's why I do what I do, because I like that that synergy, that combination of both. So yeah, you just gotta go after it and go to a nursery, pick out things that you like, you know, read the tags, go online, do a little bit of homework, and it just builds and builds.
Well, I'm really glad you said that, because an awful lot of people think they need to hire a garden designer to tell them what to plant, and it just is distressing to me that people would deliberately subsume their own
wishes and desires and their favorite colors and favorite textures for someone else's dream rather than doing their own fantasy. Mm. So I'm glad to hear that you actively promote against that.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because in some way you're kind of putting me out of a job here, Linda. but no, you bring up a good point because, you know, I am a garden designer as well and I work with clients, but I help them get started. That's my goal. A lot of people are like, okay, we'll pay you, just do it all. And I'm like, okay, fine. But at the same time, you know, you get to know the client. You talk about, you know, what they do for a living, what their lifestyle is, and can they realistically have a landscape that's going to look good, but at the same time, they're going to, like, look after it, you know? Because I've got a busy schedule, and, you know, yes, I could maybe fit them in for some maintenance here and there, but really, it's, you know, it's theirs. Mm-hmm. And people have to own their landscapes, and they have to, you know, really make it their own. So if I can help them get to that point, and then... that's the goal.
Well, I think that's the important thing is that you work with them to discover what their likes are rather than saying, well, these are the plants that do well here, and this mm-hmm. is what we're going to plant, and it almost becomes more of a commercial site than someone's residence.
Yeah. And I think when you drive down, especially like, you know, just go down, you know, Dayton Avenue here or, you know, any other street, urban street here, very similar plant palette. And I think we have the potential to just to go bigger, to do more, and people just need to kind of try and experiment and you know, not go with the same old, you know,
same old. So if you were to recommend something that you've got growing here, and I have to admit, and I'm a plant idiot when it comes to ID anyway. No. Oh, yeah. people have tried, believe me, and failed. what are some of your favorites, maybe unexpected favorites, of things that have done really well in our climate that you maybe didn't expect to do well?
Actually, we have a plant close to us that we can discuss. This is Schefflera taiwaniana, and it's a brand new introduction that a colleague of mine, Dan Hinckley, who's a very well-known plant explorer, had brought back from Taiwan, you know, taiwaniana, hence the name. And this is one of the few species of Schefflera that are actually hardy, because most people know Schefflera as that, you know, indoor plant, kind of umbrella-like leaves, you know, adds nice texture, and some are variegated and so forth. But Dan collected this in a pretty high, up in the mountains, high in elevation, where it gets quite cold. So he thought, I wonder if this could really withstand a cold in winter. So brought it back, tried it out in his garden, and they seem to spring back, so you experience a little bit of dieback, but then at the same time it comes right back up. So it's at least, you know, root hardy, which is surprising that we can grow houseplants outside.
That's
and
right.
In the ground. So again, being that it's an experiment, Linda, I have one here. Since it's raining, we're underneath the eaves of the house and by the front door. I had this in the container, so I bought two plants. So I bought one plant to grow in a container and placed it outdoors. It was in this same spot all winter last year, and then one went in the garden just to kind of, you know, test and prove, because it's one of those things that's very easy for a lot of people that are of that purchase new plants or promoting new plants, just because, yes, it's beautiful and you can hype it up as much as you know, as much as you want. I need to grow it for myself. I need to make sure that the claims are correct and that I'm just not, you know, spreading misinformation. You know a lot about that. So, you know, let's see how hardy this baby is. So I put it in a pot up against the house, one's in the ground. So right around March or so, kind of looked at both plants. The one in the ground actually died back to just bare stubs, but it was still alive. I could mm-hmm. see the base, it was still green, and it was still growing and looked fine. But surprisingly, the one in the container up against the house underneath the eaves pretty much looked almost exactly like this.
Wow.
Throughout the winter, which is surprising because generally plants in containers fully exposed tend to suffer the most damage.
Right.
So I was surprised that it came through just fine. We got some new foliage here. It looks lush, tropical, and who knew? You know, a houseplant can be grown outside. Actually, during the summer, you can have a few houseplants, you know, grow outside, but this one can stay out through the winter.
Well, it looks lovely. I mean, there's no insect damage.
Yeah.
I don't have my glasses on, but I don't see any insect damage. I see no leaf spot. I mean, it looks like, it almost looks like it's a plastic plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And this is actually a plant that's gotten a lot of hype, actually. So I wanted to make sure that the claims mm-hmm. were true. But there's actually another species of Schefflera that I think is even hardier. Because I've had it in the ground for the last 5 years, and that's Schefflera della Valle, and that one comes from Sichuan province in China, and it actually has much wider leaves, and has the undersides of it are a kind of a russet brown. It's really, really unusual, but a beautiful, beautiful plant. So bold, very architectural, and you know, between the two species, Taiwanian and della Valle, I lean towards della Valle because it's that, for me at least, proven hardiness, and but both are, in terms of texture, are very different. The Taiwanian is kind of finer, whereas the della Valle is bolder. So, but I don't know, I just get excited at the fact that, you know, it's something that people normally would associate as a houseplant growing outdoors in the Northwest as lushly as it would as if it were, you know,
someplace tropical.
Yeah. So that would be one big
Well, that's
surprise.
Great. I mean, I had noticed this here. I thought it must be a house plant that you just brought outside. Mm-hmm. And it suffered our very cold November last year then.
Oh, that was bad.
Yeah, it was bad. And a lot of stuff that had lasted for years in my garden is no longer there.
Oh,
I imagine
no.
Probably the same with yours. Oh, my Hebes are all gone.
Yeah.
All the Hebes are gone. Yeah. I'll never plant another one.
Well, that's another thing, too, that I think a lot of us gardeners in the Northwest have kind of come to that conclusion, because things like Hebes, like you mentioned, and also Phormiums, New Zealand flax, those used to be, you know, in the same nursery tables in the nurseries with the perennials. And now there's signage all over them saying annuals.
Treat as annual.
Treat as an annual.
So, although mine are in containers and I put them in the garage. And so
oh, there you
okay.
go.
Yeah.
Oh, they do okay. Just being stored in the garage?
That's right.
We've included some pictures of Riz's garden on the Garden Professor's website. That's gardenprofessors.com. Every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of our show. I get a lot of inquiries about various home remedies for the garden. Now, my colleague, Dr. Jeff Gilman, has already written a book on the truth and advertising behind many of these home remedies. So rather than repeat what he's already written about, I'd like to explain how you can develop your own GS detector. That's garden science. First, you need to filter information through what I call the credibility objectivity sieve. Now, these are just general rules of thumb, and there will always be exceptions. But in general, you want to check the credentials of the author. Are they really an expert in their field? If they have an advanced degree, is it in plant sciences? It's not to say that people can't be self-taught, but really, would you be going to someone without an MD to get medical advice? Secondly, in general, if you're looking at websites, things that end in .edu or .gov tend to be the most reliable websites. Again, it's not always true, but those websites tend to be checked over pretty carefully for facts. Third, look who's published the information if it's a book. Is it a university press or some other credible scientific publishing company? Or is it a vanity press or something that is kind of out of the mainstream? That can give you a little bit of a clue on whether the information is going to be credible or not. And then look a little bit at the author themselves and their objectivity. Do they have an ulterior motive? Are they trying to sell you something, an idea, or a new product? Do they use emotions to sway your thinking, or are they basing things on facts? Well, keeping those things in mind, I'm going to give you some tips in case you want to become a garden snake oil salesman. This is what you need to do. Always include some kind of folksy name, Spring Surprise Garden Tonic or Cousin Lucy's Mole Repellent. Be sure to use common household chemicals. Chewing tobacco, vinegar, soap, shampoo, they're all good. They all have nice toxic effects on a whole bunch of both good and bad garden plants and insects. You want to be sure to include tasty beverages, cola, beer, apple juice, Gatorade, instant tea. Hey, they're good for you. It's got to be good for your garden. Use lots and lots of fertilizers, but give them friendly names like Epsom salts or bone meal or natural organic garden food or fish emulsion or wood ash. Don't worry about the nutrient load. It's all natural. Sometimes add a special ingredient like urine. Treat all gardening tasks with a recipe mentality. You can solve any problem just following a recipe, right? Be sure to appeal to emotions. Don't worry about facts. And pretend that plants are just like people. Things that appeal to you, hey, they'll appeal to plants too. And finally, don't even try to explain how a remedy works. This is all based on faith, not reality. Really, whenever you're in doubt about information and how valid it is, every state has an extension specialist, and you can even ask specialists outside your state. Specialists are faculty that have relevant PhDs in applied plant sciences specifically for gardening. And you can find them at your local land-grant university, or you can find them online. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. That's my official WSU webpage, and it's full of free and great information. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I've hoped you've found this podcast and the others entertaining and useful. I welcome your comments and questions. You can reach me at lindacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be Better Red Than Dead.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, as well as other stories and articles she's written, please visit informedgardener.com, gardenprofessors.com, or sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. Thank you to Large Media, executive producer and production direction, and the WSU faculty and staff. Happy gardening!